Hashtag Me Too comes to crime fiction.
The main perpetrator in the book is actually based on a real human being, someone I knew and was on a board with, who it was disclosed about 3 years ago had done a terrible thing when he was a young lawyer to a teenage girl. And the story haunted me. It simply haunted me. He lost his job, as he should have, and I just couldn't shake the story from my mind.
That's Linda Fairstein. We talk with her about her latest in the Alexandra Cooper series, Blood Oath. Then we re-air our 2018 interview with Tana French about her crime novel, The Witch Elm. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. And hey, do you know you can go to writersvoice.net to sign up for our free podcast and weekly newsletter? Find extra content there with links, book excerpts, and extended interviews. When Linda Fairstein headed the sex crimes unit of the DA's office in Manhattan, it was before the hashtag MeToo movement. But she was well aware of the problem of sexual harassment and worse. She turned her talents later to writing crime fiction, putting her protagonist and possibly alter ego, assistant DA Alexandra Cooper, at the head of the office Fairstein used to run. Now, 20 books into the series, Fairstein has come out with a page-turner of a thriller about a predatory prosecutor with political ambitions and his victim, a young woman named Lucy. After years of keeping the assault secret, Lucy brings her hashtag MeToo case to Cooper, who then has to buck the establishment to go up against some very powerful men. We speak with Linda Fairstein not only about Blood Oath, but also about sex crimes against women and girls and what it was like to prosecute them in the 1970s and 80s. Linda Fairstein, thank you so much for coming on to Writer's Voice. We're talking about this really terrific book, Blood Oath.
Thank you. I'm very, very pleased to be with you, and also so grateful that there are still shows like Writer's Voice. We've lost so many outlets to talk about books and literature and writing, and it's terrific.
Well, thank you for that. You know, this was actually the first book of yours that I read, and after I finished it, I went out and started reading some of the others because I love your writing, and you also cover some very important issues. You were the chief of the sex crimes unit of the DA's office in Manhattan for 2 decades. And this is the 20th in your Alexandra Cooper series, very much in the tradition of hashtag Me Too. Others of your novels deal with sex trafficking and other issues around sexual crimes. How did your work as a sex crimes investigator motivate you to become a mystery writer?
Good question, Francesca. All of my youth, I wanted to write, and in every yearbook entry, what do you want to do when you grow up? So I've loved books, reading literature. I've always loved crime novels. Start as the pre-adolescent with Nancy Drew, and then I think Sherlock Holmes, my all-time favorite. And while I read widely and was an English lit major, I've always come back for pleasure to this genre. And went to law school, wanted a career in public service, and always hoped, sort of dreamed, that someday I would get back to doing this. But the job as a prosecutor really gave me the impetus to write with the authenticity of someone doing the work. So for me, these are what I would call, in the subgenre, these are procedurals that really explore how a case, in fact, would be handled by police and prosecutors. It's not an amateur sleuth. It's not somebody in an Agatha Christie novel, you know, sorting out the poison mushrooms. It's really the way these cases are handled. So that's the fact-to-fiction, fiction-to-fact combination.
Yeah, and that's what really made it so fascinating. And also, you know, the relevance, they can, well, it's always relevant, but now even more so because of hashtag MeToo, the relevance of the topic. Before we leave our listeners too much longer in puzzlement, just give us a very brief sense of the plot and the main character first, Alexandra Cooper.
So Blood Oath opens, Alex has been on leave for the equivalent of a couple of months, which is really two previous novels, because she had a bad experience and decided to take a leave of absence. And I heard from so many readers that they wanted her back strong. They wanted her in full force again. They didn't like the Alex who was kind of whimpering as she recovered. So the first scene is in the courtroom where she's going to battle against a judge who's bullying one of the colleagues who works in her unit. And chapter two, we are right into the main mystery. Young woman named Lucy, who's 24 years old, has appeared at a police precinct, brought to Alex. She is reporting that 10 years earlier, she was the victim of a sexual assault. The person she is accusing, at first reluctantly, but because I think of the Me Too movement, she says, the person she's accusing has become a very prominent individual, prominent in law enforcement, and actually known to Alex Cooper. So it's complex in a legal sense, trying to prove or disprove Lucy's story, and then a prominent in the sense that Alex knows him and what will happen next.
Yeah, and I'll come back to that last point in a moment. But, you know, there are a number of powerful men behaving pretty badly in this book. You mentioned them both, a judge who, you know, is maybe that's a minor plot point, but he is accused of domestic violence. And then this chief prosecutor, Zach, who Cooper knows. And you even referred at one point, not by name, to Eric Schneiderman in the book. Did he provide any of the Eric Schneiderman being the previous Attorney General of New York, who was accused of really horrific assaults against women? Did he provide some of the inspiration for these characters?
Well, he didn't. He provided the inspiration for the use of his own name as a real bad actor that I could name. Zachary, the main perpetrator in the book, the bad guy in the book, is actually based on a real human being. I've not named him, but someone I knew and was on a board with, who it was disclosed about 3 years ago, had done a terrible thing when he was a young lawyer to a teenage girl. And the story haunted me. It simply haunted me. He lost his job, as he should have. I believe he was disbarred. He's from another place, not New York. And I just couldn't shake the story from my mind. Not only his fall from grace due to his own horrible behavior, but how he had completely, in her own words, ruined and derailed the life of the young woman he had abused, who had been too reluctant, fearing she wouldn't be believed, to ever report it. So I think part of my point was, when I started to write, we were still at a point where a lot of people just didn't believe that accomplished men with degrees and men in powerful positions were guilty of some of these horrible acts. And most of the rest of us know that there are no such boundaries.
Over the course of your two decades working as chief of the Sex Crimes Unit in New York, in Manhattan, have you seen a change in the willingness, or did you see a change in the willingness of women to come forward about sexual abuse, or was that too much? And if not, do you think something has changed now with Me Too? I just wonder if you could, you know, delve into that whole issue of reporting.
So keep in mind, this will sound like ancient history to your, well, it is ancient history to your listeners. I graduated from law school and joined the DA's office in 1972, a very long time ago. And there were 200 lawyers on the staff. Only 7 were women. There was no special victims unit in any prosecutor's office in the country. So that was its own bad fact. Our laws in every state were so archaic that most survivors were denied the opportunity to go to court, independent evidence being required by the law. Very bad laws that we had adapted and adopted from British common law that was really medieval. And again, 1972, that was 14 years before DNA had ever been applied to forensics to be used in a courtroom. So we, many, first to your question, at that time, most survivors were reluctant to come forward because the laws were bad, victims were blamed, and the justice system rarely admitted them to court and forget about winning in the courtroom. Mm-hmm. As we changed laws throughout the 70s, we began to encourage women to trust us to come into the system. So I saw enormous changes in the mid to late 70s and in the early 80s. And those changes just continued to increase the number of survivors coming to us. And eventually, we tried so many different methods, science being in the form of DNA, the most dramatic in revolutionizing the way that we in the system could help women. And I don't mean that things plateaued, but until then, the Me Too conversation started, and many powerful men were identified, and some are being brought to justice. That was sort of the next floodgate opening that has seen a great increase in the number of women coming forward, some of them about crimes that are very remote in time.
Yeah, and I believe New York State just passed a law greatly expanding the, and may have taken it out altogether, the, what is it called, the statute of limitations for childhood sexual abuse. Could you weigh in on that?
Yes, I wrote an op-ed about it, which probably can be found on my website 2 years ago in favor of changing this law. It grew out of a number of circumstances, but one of the most powerful were the cases involving clergy in which so many of the young victims had been prevented from coming forward because so many years had elapsed since their victimization. And there are enough troubles in proving crimes remote in time without just forbidding it altogether. And finally, I don't think much more than a month ago, in the last couple of months, the legislation allowing child victims to bring cases against their offenders was passed by the state legislature, and that's in New York. And that is a huge bit of progress and step forward for so many victims of violence who just felt they had been denied any kind of access at all.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, you know, another aspect of this, and one that you hint about in this book, Linda Fairstein, in Blood Oath, your 20th of the Alexandra Cooper novels, is sexual harassment on the job. You know, women working in law enforcement and in the judicial system. Was that something you were very aware of when you were chief of the sex crimes unit? And if so, how did you deal with it?
I think everybody, I mean, again, I'll take your listeners back to a very different point in time and the 60s and 70s when so many careers were blocked for women trying to enter them. There was just harassment of, before you even got to sexual, of another kind. For those of us who entered criminal justice at about the time I did, it was a very male-dominated world. There were, as I say, 7 women on a staff of 200 in my office. The DA himself told me that the work was too tawdry for women and didn't allow women to be in the courtroom prosecuting murder cases. He said you shouldn't be listening to, talking about blood and guts and violence of that sort. And it was there was an equal opportunity Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, EEOC, founded in 68 or 69, it just had no teeth. So in 72, there was nothing I could say to the powerful DA that was going to change the way he felt. The NYPD was very male-dominated. Police women had not been allowed to be detectives. They were called police matrons till right around 1970, not allowed to do detective work on the streets for the most part. And I think there were in Manhattan maybe only two women judges on the bench when I started. So a lot of the language wouldn't be tolerated today. There were women who came to me in my office reporting to me, and then I would take it up the ladder that they had been harassed by supervisors, and not always were those matters disposed of in a way that anybody would find satisfactory today. There was a great deal of resistance to characterizing someone that way, and I don't even remember that the word harassment was used in that period.
When, in fact, did the word sexual harassment on the job come in? Was that with Anita Hill?
I think it entered into common usage then. So there were probably some people before she testified who used that phrase, but it was not a common expression.
And the other thing is, you know, I'm struck by you saying 1970, 1972, 1970, which I remember well as also, was the year that the women's movement began. And it was the year that I went to my first consciousness-raising session, thinking that I was going to be meeting a bunch of women who were, you know, man-hating women who couldn't get a man, and walked out of that saying, I'm a feminist. What was that for you? I mean, do you feel like the women's movement made a critical difference in how you were able to do your job?
Yes. Well, I take it back a few years earlier. I went to an all-women's college at the time, Vassar, got out in 69, and I'm pretty sure Ms. Magazine started in the late 60s, and it was really the women's magazines that began to talk about sexual assault and rape at a time when the mainstream media would not cover it. And I know there was a small but growing feminist movement at Vassar at my last 2 years, 68, 69. There were rallies of all kinds, as we used to do then, about just about any subject that you could think to rally about. But it was really by 72 when I was at the DA's office and 73 handling my first sexual assault cases, it was really a grassroots movement. There was an organization called Women Against Rape in New York and in many other locations. Most of its members were themselves survivors of sexual violence who were trying to move the system along. And as I've written often, I think in Blood Oath and in other books, the sad thing is that the impetus for change in this regard did not come from within the criminal justice system. It was not judges and prosecutors and people saying, this has to change, it's not acceptable. It was really grassroots, and it was pretty much survivors who finally made themselves heard to the point at which they've been denied justice for so long that the criminal justice system and legislators began to take them seriously.
Well, that's terrific. If you just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Linda Fairstein about her latest in her Alexandra Cooper mystery stories, Blood Oath. One of the things that I found so useful was your description of how perpetrators of, pedophiles, how they groom their victims over a long period of time. So tell us about the grooming process that sexual predators engage in, especially as pedophiles.
So I think, and certainly for me, even as a professional, as a young professional, when we came upon these cases, I didn't realize what the process was that we now come to know and call grooming. And it's really how the offender trains his victim to follow his commands and do what he wants to do. And so there's the ability of the predator to pick the vulnerable witness, often a child who's got a problem situation at home. In my case, in Lucy's case, she was 14. Her mother died. She was sent to live with relatives she didn't get along with. So she was a runaway. So there you've got somebody without direct parental supervision, or in many other cases, loose parental supervision, well-meaning parents who both work or work in this day and age two jobs, and you've got a latchkey kid. The predator then begins to often give gifts, small gifts that are tokens of affection, but are material things that perhaps the child has never had before. Short trips are usually involved. In my case, the predator had a fancy car and took his victim for a ride. It's increasing steps, all meant to isolate the object of his affection or his intention, to isolate her, sometimes him, from whoever the caregiver is, and make himself the caregiver, make himself seem to be the person who's more interested. And it's usually a gradual process, and it's usually it's always designed to get the child alone, to explain that he's going to do something for her that's going to make her feel better, feel more adult, feel that she can only trust him and depend on him. And the title Blood Oath comes from the way my particular predator chooses, with an old-fashioned kind of medieval blood oath, to keep their secret, that if they cut themselves and press their pinkies together and exchange blood, then something terrible would happen to her if she ever revealed the secret. So it's grooming, and people can look it up online, is just now an accepted manner, and I don't mean accepted by the courts, but accepted by psychologists as the manner in which predators get their victims sort of under their spell.
Yeah, it describes the process. Now, there was something that puzzled me in this book, Blood Oath, Linda Fairstein, where Alexandra Cooper is talking about a man who tries to strangle a woman, but there's no actual injury. Cooper says this is still a crime. Someone questions her, is that a crime because there hasn't been an actual injury? I wonder if you could clear this up for us.
Sure. So this is a relatively new phenomenon, but in studies of domestic violence, which has obviously been taken more seriously in the last decade in courts and in this country, often in domestic situations, there's verbal abuse first and then some kind of physical abuse. And one of the primary indicators of someone's willingness or perhaps ability to grow into a stage of causing serious physical injury or harm to people, to a loved one, is when, let's say it's a male, puts his hands on the neck of the victim to try and stop her from breathing, so choking her. And it's considered now in the domestic violence community an actual indicator of the potential this person has to cause the death of another person. It's different than slapping across the face, which isn't going to kill you. It's going to hurt, may leave a red mark. It's not going to kill you. It's different than other so-called relatively minor kinds of physical abuse. So choking actually is probably the most recent set of laws in the criminal law when a man puts his hands on the throat of another person, which never used to be a crime if he didn't cause injury. And now it's been recognized to be a precursor to the use of deadly force. So it gets a small mention in this book, and of course often hard to prove. Sometimes there's finger marks or a red mark, but that's not actual injury under the law. So that's what Cook's explaining.
So it's not an attempted crime. It's a crime. Is it a felony or a misdemeanor? Or does that matter?
Usually it's a misdemeanor. I think if it leaves marks or there's something else involved, I believe it's a felony.
Interesting. Now, there's mention of something else that surprised me in Blood Oath, and that is that #MeToo has had a paradoxical impact of lessening the willingness of some jurors to be on such cases. Is this true? And if so, why?
Yeah. So, it's had, in your words, a paradoxical effect. I mean, there are people who are fully supportive of the motion and of women who avail themselves of the ability to come forward, even at a late date, to say what's happened. And there are people who, as Alex finds out when she tries to put this in the grand jury, there are people who think it's gone too far and open the floodgates. And how do you make a judgment about something that may have happened 10, 12, 15 years ago when there's no forensic evidence? And I think there's a fair amount of literature that proves that there's not 100% acceptance of the issue. And so Alex, for the first time, she's not even before a jury, but she's taking the preliminary step of going to a grand jury right after Me Too has kind of opened up, and that's what she's met with first time in.
So how do you deal with the ambiguities of hashtag Me Too? I mean, there are people who feel like Al Franken was unfairly treated because, you know, he didn't do very much and it was mostly before he was a congressman, and other people like, you know, Jeffrey Epstein, who seemed to be getting away with the most horrendous kind of pedophilia.
Yeah. Well, you just made a good point and how you deal with it. I mean, it's, to me, like every other series of crimes, is such a range of things. And for many reporters, I think, sadly, there's just been no nuance in characterizing. So people put the worst offenders in the same breath as someone who may have committed an offense only once. It may not be as egregious. I mean, rape is certainly, to me, not to be used in the same phrase as someone who may have touched the buttocks of a person. So we in the law have to break down all those differences. And I think we see on campus that there's a great, and there have been studies about this, a tremendously wrong overuse of the word rape. And everybody's a rapist, which has a very specific definition requiring intercourse, forcible intercourse, when in fact some of the cases are forced kissing or ambiguous kissing or too much alcohol and nobody remembers what happened. So, you know, there's just a tremendous, Alex Cooper would require everyone to factually break down the difference of what each guy did or what each has claimed to do. And I think that's really important as we get these stories from the media and need to analyze them more.
Well, that is so fascinating. And this book, you know, which was a terrific read and very entertaining, was so educational as well. Linda Fairstein, thank you so much for talking with us on Writer's Voice about your latest, Blood Oath, your 20th in the Alexandra Cooper series.
Francesca, thanks for having me. And, of course, knowing that there are writer's shows out there still exist is something we all long to be part of.
Linda Fairstein. Read an excerpt from Blood Oath at writersvoice.net. Next up, Tana French talks about her novel, The Witch Elm. We spoke with her in 2018. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. I invite you to sign up for the Writer's Voice podcast and newsletter at writersvoice.net. You can find more great content there, including web-only features like book recommendations and extended interviews. Now, let's hear my 2018 interview with Tana French about her mystery novel, The Witch Elm. When we last interviewed American-Irish writer Tana French in 2016 about her novel, The Trespasser, I wrote that she's been called the most interesting, most important crime novelist to emerge in the past 10 years. She earned that reputation for her Dublin Murder Squad crime series, of which The Trespasser was one. Now she's out with a new novel, but it isn't part of that series, or any series for that matter. Instead of telling the story from the point of view of police detectives, The Witch Elm tells it from the point of view of, well, one of us, an ordinary person, someone for whom a murder that happens in their circle is a profoundly disorienting and unsettling experience. The book's protagonist is Toby Hennessy, a young man of good looks, good luck, and a sunny personality. But his luck runs out when he's the victim of a brutal assault that leaves him with a damaged brain and PTSD. Then, as if things couldn't get worse, a skull is discovered in a tree on a family property, and Toby becomes one of the suspects. When you pick up a Tana French novel, you know you're in for a deep exploration of character and motive. The Witch Elm is no exception to that rule. It concerns itself with two big questions. The first, what may be some of the negative consequences of being, in air quotes, lucky? What does it do to our ability to feel compassion for others less lucky than ourselves? The second question follows hard on the heels of the first. How do we cope when our sense of self is upended by trauma, especially when we're used to being lucky? And how to build a new sense of self on a perhaps more solid foundation? What Toby learns about himself in the course of wrestling with those questions doesn't necessarily improve his luck, but it does make him a deeper, more humble, and compassionate person. Tana French is the winner of the Edgar Award and the Irish Book Award, among other honors. The Witch Elm is her seventh novel. The previous six are in the Dublin Murder Squad series. Tana French, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
Thank you for having me back on.
The Witch Elm, I think I say this each time I read one of your books. This is my favorite, but this one is my favorite.
Thank you so much. I'm very glad.
Now, it's the witch is spelled W-Y-C-H. Is there any such a thing as a witch elm?
Yeah, there is. It's a tree that is, it's fairly common in England and Ireland anyway, and it shows up here and there in various forms of mythology and sort of medieval herbals. And in ancient Greek mythology, one grew at the entrance to the underworld. So I thought it was an interesting thing to have in the book.
So we've talked with you about two previous novels, The Trespasser and The Secret Place. Mm-hmm. These are both in the Dublin Murder Squad series. And the last time we talked, you hinted that the next book would not be one of the Dublin Murder Squad series, which is the case here. Why did you decide to take this avenue here, to go outside that series and do a standalone book? I assume it's standalone.
Yes, it is a standalone book. Basically, I think it's very easy, especially if you're writing within the same genre where the overall framework is pretty much fixed. There's a temptation to get into writing the same book over and over. And I had, the parameters of the Dublin Murder Squad were pretty much in place. And I think it would have been quite easy to slide into that. And I don't want to do that. So I decided to take a step back from the series for a while. And I looked at the process of a criminal investigation from the detective's point of view six times. But I kept thinking about all the other people involved. Like, you've got perpetrators, witnesses, suspects, victims. How is that criminal investigation going to look from their point of view, from their perspective? Like, for the detective, all the procedural stuff, the detective's completely at home with that. He or she is, they're the one controlling it and driving it, and it's a source of power, of strength, and it's a way of, like, reestablishing order in a chaotic world. But for all those other people involved, the investigation's got to look completely different. It's alien and it's incomprehensible, and it has to be quite often terrifying. It's, rather than giving them control, it takes control away, and it's a source of chaos. It upends their whole lives. And I wanted to give a voice to all of those other perspectives as well, and Toby Hennessy, the narrator, is at various points in the book, he's all of those things.
So, Toby, tell us about this narrator. It's all from his point of view. He's the major protagonist, but there are other very, very strong characters in the book. Tell us about him.
Toby is basically a happy-go-lucky young guy with a nice life, good job in PR, lovely girlfriend, good friends. Basically, everything in life has always gone his way. He's always been lucky. And that has been nice for him, obviously, but there are ways in which it stunted him emotionally. He's never had to think very much about the fact that other people might not be living life on quite as easy a difficulty setting as he is. That for other people, the experience of just living in this world might be a very different thing. from what it is to him. He's basically existed in a state of cheerful oblivion until one night burglars break into his apartment and beat him up pretty badly, and he's left with traumatic brain injury with not the worst side effects you can have, but there's a certain amount of, he's got difficulty with speech, with memory, with a limp, and he's also got post-traumatic stress disorder. And his entire sense of himself is shattered and transformed, and his entire sense of his relationship to the world around him.
Yes, you know, you were reviewed by Stephen King, and who gave you a rave review, by the way, in the New York Times, which was fantastic.
I'm still recovering from that. I'm still picking my jaw up off the floor, Stephen King, wow.
Yeah. Now, he says, you know, he starts out the review with the first sentence in your book, being, quote, "I've always considered myself to be basically a lucky person." And he says that the book is a meditation on luck. So I wanted to ask you first, what did you think about that?
I think that's very much, yes, what I was hoping that it would do. Because I had been thinking, where the book came out of was, I've been thinking a lot about luck and what it can do to our sense of empathy, whether it can stunt empathy. Like, if you're too lucky in some field of life, it can be quite hard to realize that other people are living in different realities and that their experience may be very different from yours. I mean, my most obvious example is I had a pretty happy, well-loved childhood. And for me, that meant that when I was a teenager, say, if somebody told me about their really terrible childhood, there would be a part of my brain that was going, I can't have been that bad. They've got to be exaggerating. It wasn't that I thought the person was lying. It was just that this was so outside my frame of reference that I had no way of taking it in as reality. And, you know, I grew up and I realized that, no, actually, my reality does not define everybody else's. But I started thinking about, what about somebody who had been lucky in every way all through his life, who, you know, he's white, male, straight, mentally healthy, physically healthy, good-looking, charming, all of it.
Wealthy.
What would that do to his ability? Yeah, wealthy, from a stable home, like I said. What would that do to his ability to recognize that other people are not living in that world? And what would it do if suddenly his luck changed and his entire perception of the world and of himself was shattered?
Right. And I'll come back to that, but it's actually what you say, the very last thing that you said there, that had me thinking that there's really also an other theme to the book, which is identity, personality. What happens when we go through a trauma and we have to question everything about ourselves?
Yes, absolutely. I was thinking a lot about that as well, because we all have been through those moments where you feel like something in you has been shattered or irrevocably transformed. And what do you do about it? To what extent are you able to rebuild or to pick yourself up or to reframe your mental image of yourself and carry on from that point? And Toby finds that extremely difficult. And all the other characters in the book have, at different points in their life, gone through these upheavals. And one of the characters, his Uncle Hugo, who is dying of brain cancer, has a line where he says something like, one gets used to being oneself, and it takes some great upheaval to crack that and show you what else might be lying underneath. And I think those moments can be, depending on how they're approached, very revelatory and show you what else has been lying inside waiting for its moment. And all the characters deal with these moments of devastation and transformation in very different ways.
Yes, I mean, I personally can relate to that because last year I was diagnosed with breast cancer, which luckily I think has been cured. But I always thought of myself as a healthy person. And after that happened, I cannot take my health for granted. So this was a very moving to me what Toby goes through, because after all, he has PTSD, he has memory lapse, and it leads to a kind of, even one could say, overcompensation, a kind of paranoia, whereas before he might have thought everything was rosy in life and nothing too bad could happen. Now he doesn't know if the worst can happen.
Yes. I'm really sorry you went through that. Glad to hear that. Fingers crossed, everything is back back to normal. But I think it isn't something that you get past mentally, even when it's over physically, because the world is in fact a different place. And that's what happened to him. It's everything's quicksand. Everything that he thought of as a solid surface is quicksand now. And he doesn't know how to respond to that. And as you say, we've all been through that moment where suddenly everything that you took for granted in yourself and in the world is no longer there.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Tana French about her newest mystery novel, The Witch Elm. So now this, his sunny disposition, his erstwhile luck, although one could argue in some ways he's lucky throughout the book, even so, is in stark contrast to at least one of his cousins. Now, he has two cousins in the book who are more like siblings to him. That's Susanna and Leon. Tell us about them and their relationship to each other, at least as mediated through his own thinking, because that's the only point of view we have in the book.
Yes, they are, as far as he's concerned, at the beginning of the book anyway, the three of them roughly grew up together, running in and out of the Ivy House and staying there together for holidays. They're all about the same age within a few months. And as far as he's concerned, this was all very idyllic. They had a great time together, picnics and camping out in the garden and teenage parties. From his perspective, this was all absolutely lovely. But as the book continues, he's forced to reevaluate all of that because from their perspective, there were entirely different things and much darker and more fragmented things going on. And he starts to realize that their relationship with each other was in some ways an alliance from which he was excluded. Because while he was having the easiest time that anyone can have with adolescence, which is, by definition, not an easy time, they were not. They were having much more difficult times. They were having almost daily struggles to keep it together and to keep themselves from being bullied or picked on, harassed in various ways. And they feel that he was not there for them in the way that he has always thought of himself as being. And so this is another thing that he's having to reassess, and where he's not able really to hold on to his perception of himself is within that relationship with his cousins, which was a very defining relationship for him. And he's being forced to accept their definition of it as having a certain validity as well. But this idea of different viewpoints being different is, again, very destabilizing and frightening for him at a point when everything else is unstable, too.
Mm, exactly. So let's talk a little bit about the plot then. You have this terrible assault on Toby in the beginning of the book. And then about halfway through, it becomes apparent that a murder has been committed, although it hasn't been committed in any recent time. But long ago, this is a skull is found in the Witch Elm. This is where the Witch Elm comes in. And this is at Ivy House, where Uncle Hugo is. Tell us about the situation here. Toby is in Ivy House with his Uncle Hugo and with his girlfriend Melissa.
Yes, and for him, this is the Ivy House, is this idyllic haven that was his favorite place through childhood. And he's come back here, and he feels that in a way it's putting him back together. It's reconnecting him with his past, his cousins, his old self. And his cousins are, in many ways, the definers of his old self. They're the people who knew him when he was too little to have any kind of sense of concealment or company manners or anything like that. They've known the core of him since day one, and he associates them with the place. So this is very much a healing experience for him, and he's starting to stick himself back together. And just at the point where he feels like he might just get back on some kind of stability again, a skull is found down the trunk of this big witch elm at the bottom of the garden. And of course, this prompts an entire criminal investigation, which naturally enough is focused on anybody who has access to the garden of the Ivy House, meaning Toby and his family. And so that triggers this entire destabilization of his sense of his past and who, not only who he is now, but who he was when he was younger. And it also puts him under threat, not just psychologically, but in much more concrete terms, because there are detectives in and out questioning him, questioning his cousins, questioning his uncle, and he doesn't know what they're thinking. He doesn't know who they might suspect of what, and he, of course, can't even trust his memory, so he doesn't even know who he should be suspecting of what.
In fact, he suspects himself.
At certain points in the book, he does, yeah. Because he doesn't know what else might be in there in his mind at this point. Everything is up for grabs. Nothing is stable. So he has no idea what else might be in there.
Right. I hope I didn't give anything away by saying that.
I don't think that's too spoilers.
Now, you know, it's interesting. The book, there are long stretches in the book where there's no external action happening. What's really, or there's no, like, the plot is not being driven forward. The murder mystery itself is not being driven forward. It's a real exploration of the psychological landscape, the interior landscape of Toby, and also of his relationship, all the things that we've just been talking about. Now, one reviewer, criticized it, thought it went on too long that way. I disagree with that. I found it fascinating precisely because, well, your work is very much about the psychological mysteries in the human heart, and it allows us to delve into them. And also, the writing is absolutely terrific. But I wonder if that took a bit of courage on your part to kind of let the action, the external action of the book, lie fallow for so long.
Yeah, it was a risk, and I knew it was a risk. But I'm less interested when it comes to any mystery. I'm less interested in who done it. I'm much more interested in why done it and in what this huge upheaval of murder does to everybody surrounded by it, how it affects their minds, how it sends ripples out to change everything that touches it. And especially when you're doing something as kind of psychologically enormous as what I was taking on in this one, which is his entire sense of identity, sense of the world. These are some pretty core human mysteries. Who are we? How much are we stable and how much of us is fluid? To what extent can we be changed and shaped by what goes on around us versus to what extent are we just who we are and to what extent is that a stable thing within us? I figured that's something that I have to allow the space to develop properly if it's going to have any depth, if the character is going to have the resonance and the depth to pull this off. So I don't know. I hope that every bit within it drives forward that core plot question of who is Toby turning into as we watch him? What is he going to turn into now that his original self has been broken and he's just left with the pieces? And I hope that even when the whodunit element isn't being driven forward, that the fact that the core mystery of who Toby is and who he's going to be able to make himself into now that himself has been shattered and he's just been left with the pieces, I hope that that will be enough to keep readers moving forward with him.
Well, absolutely. You know, he starts out being this golden boy. He goes through this trauma, and he becomes a much deeper, more thoughtful person by the end.
Yes, I think so, and I hope so. And he does transform over the course of the book. And to me, that was the core plot arc of the book. I mean, I'm always about characters. I love gripping plots, and I love reading and try to write plots that keep hold of you. But for me, it's always about the character. That's who I'm interested in. What's their journey? Where are they going to end up, and how are they going to get there? So I'm fascinated by that. So I just kind of keep my fingers crossed that enough readers are happy for that to be the core arc of the book.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Tana French, mystery writer extraordinaire, about her newest novel, The Witch Elm. Now, I was reading this book while the Kavanaugh, the hearings for Judge Kavanaugh to be a member of the Supreme Court were going on. And there is a line in the book that very much resonated with those external events. A young man who has been quite abusive, let's say, to a woman in the book. And I found it really striking. You always have used your novels to explore some of the social issues that are going on. And of course, you wrote this way before Judge Kavanaugh, but perhaps at the same time that our president, who also has been accused of sexual assault, was in fact, you know, running for office. So I wonder if you could talk about how you weave in these contemporary social issues and controversies into your work.
It's definitely and genuinely not deliberate. I never set out to write a book with a social message or a book that taps into social issues. But I think that if you're writing, and for some reason I think especially if you're writing mystery, it's very easy for social context to come in. Because murder happens in every society, every time and place. But the reasons for which it happens and the way it happens are very much shaped by that time and place and by, you know, the tensions and the fears and the dark places within it. And so I think, although I don't set out to integrate social issues into it, if this is what you're hearing about and thinking about, and if you're trying to think through what's my own response to this shift in society where people are no longer expected to accept simply being lesser citizens, but, you know, a few of those who have been in a position of power are unwilling to relinquish their position of power. If there's this tension going on in the society all around you, and this growing awareness from people who have never realized what other people's lives are like, there's this growing awareness of, oh my God, you know, take the Me Too movement. More and more men becoming aware, that's what women's daily lives are like? Seriously? How did I never know this? If this sudden explosion around the issue of empathy and other and recognizing others' experience is happening, I think it's very easy for it to seep into what you're doing as a writer, and in particular as a mystery writer, almost on a subconscious level.
Mm-hmm. You know, your writing just is so stellar, and yet it seems so effortless. Did you experience any real challenge in writing this book in particular?
Oh yeah, I with all of the books, it's there are different challenges. With this one, it was, I really enjoyed writing this one, oddly enough. It was one of the ones that I found the most, it's going to sound strange, but that I found the most fun, purely because it's set in a different world. I didn't have any of the parameters and the boundaries set down that I had for the Dublin Murder Squad. Like when I was writing, not the first one, but all the others, there were certain things I knew I couldn't do because I'd already set out the outlines of this world, the Dublin Murder Squad world. But this one, I could do anything. Anything could happen. There were no rules left. But while that is a lot of fun, it was also kind of scary because I was going, okay, am I doing this all wrong? Because I have nothing left that I can say, okay, it worked last time, it's probably okay. I was completely in uncharted territory, and that can be pretty scary. And there's also the fact that, as you've said, this is less procedural heavy and less driven by the murder investigation itself. And I was going, okay, I kind of need that structural arc of the murder investigation to keep me into place, because I write long anyway. I like writing. I like going off on little discursive tangents. And I was going, if I don't have that arc firmly nailed into place at beginning and end of the book, I could just keep writing and turn in a million-word book in 5 years' time. So that was a little bit scary.
Well, and tell us a little bit about your writing process. I mean, do you do this every day? Do you get up at 6 o'clock in the morning and write till noon? How does it work for you?
Well, in an ideal world, I'd kind of write until 3 a.m. and then sleep till 11, but I have little kids, so that is not happening. So I write when they're out of my hair, basically, once they're both in school, then I write until they're not anymore, and which is, I think, probably as many hours as I could do in a day anyway, because I tend to edit and re-edit and re-edit a bit that I've done, so that by the time I finish a first draft, I'm only a few weeks away from handing it in, because I edit every bit as I go. So mainly, yeah, the process is working around small kids and their needs. That and a a lot of caffeine and a lot of long walks. Those are my two main crutches as a writer.
And I have to say, then, I'm not surprised at some of the characterizations of little kids in this book, The Witch Elm.
Little kids are fun to write, and they're fun to write because the same thing as a structure. They follow their own rules. They have their own agenda and are living in a parallel world, so that's always fun to write.
Absolutely. Well, Tana French, it was hugely fun to read The Witch Elm, and I want to thank you so much for talking with us again on Writer's Voice, and I look forward to another conversation about your next book, which I'm sure is coming.
Thank you, and thank you so much for having me back on.
Tana French. Go to writersvoice.net to read an excerpt from The Witch Elm. Next week on Writer's Voice, we talk with Eric Blank about his book, Red State Revolt. It's about the teacher strikes in West Virginia, Oklahoma, and Arizona. We also talk with Gregory Pardlow about his stunning memoir, Air Traffic. And don't forget to go to writersvoice.net. I'm starting to put up chapters of my just-finished memoir, Province of the Heart. It's a post-9/11 memoir of Provence. We have just a little time left to tell you about some of the great books we're looking to cover in coming episodes, either through author interviews or reviews. First, I'm really excited to read the great nature writer Barry Lopez's new book, Horizon. It's a memoir and a journey through some of the places that he's been to, the Galapagos, Australia, Kenya, and Antarctica. Then Jason Green's memoir about the accidental death of his 2-year-old daughter is a searing and intimate look at recovering from tragedy. It's called Once More We Saw Stars. Then two books that look at our southern border. Octavio Solis's Retablos is a collection of stories from a life lived along the border. And Dan Werb's City of Omens is about a search for the missing women of the borderlands. We'll keep you posted. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Do you know you can go to writersvoice.net to sign up for our podcast and weekly newsletter? Find extra content there with links, book excerpts, and extended interviews. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.